From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the poet Barbara Buckman Strosko, author of two collections of poetry, Graffiti in Braille, and a chapbook, On the Edge of a Delicate Day. A third, The Opposite of Lightning, comes out soon from Word Poetry Books. Barbara lives along the Conestoga River in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Her poem, Bricks and Mortar, was chosen to be engraved in granite and bronze in Lancaster's main square. She was appointed the first poet laureate of Lancaster County by the Lancaster Literary Guild. Barbara Strosko's poems have appeared in Best New Poets, Rhino, Poet Lore, Brilliant Corners, Ninth Letter, and Nimrod. She was a finalist for the 2012 New Letters Poetry Award and has received a Pushcart Prize nomination and is the recipient of a fellowship to the Norman Mailer Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Barbara was the 2009 Teacher of the Year for River of Words, an international environmental youth poetry and art contest. She was a counselor, reading specialist, and literacy coach for the School District of Lancaster for many years. She holds an MFA in writing from the Vermont College of Fine Arts and a master's degree in psychology from Millersville University. She currently serves as the poet in the schools for Poetry Paths in the city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. When I spoke with Barbara in 2013, I began by asking her to read her poem titled Bruise. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Bruise. When the hawk flies from the sunset on the other side of the sky to the grove of trees by the river, my throat tightens. My eyes rest not on the hawk, but on its shadow, on rock, all belief suspended, and the bruise of light wavering on rims of bark. I recall the yellow light of the sun starting to descend, and the way the neighbors sit on their side porches to watch. What is it these people yearn for? My own desires, so strong they are written on my skin, but in a foreign language, deciphered, when the shadow of the hawk in this remaining light takes flight. Curving the hill in silence, cut from ruins.
Thank you for reading that. That's the opening poem to the collection, Graffiti in Braille, by Barbara Buckman Strosko, published by WordPress. I love that poem. It's just a beautiful opening poem. And as you're reading it, I'm picturing you sitting outside and watching this bird circling. And it just makes me wonder the extent to which you write in the setting of your work, or how much are you writing from memories and notes that you've taken?
Yeah, well, this poem I definitely did write standing out on my porch. I live along the river, the Conestoga River. And I often write, you know, outside. But, you know, sometimes I do take notes. It's a little harder in the winter to be outside, so I do like to write. I do like to write in the setting I am.
Yeah. The idea of that shadow crossing over you and then the sort of subtle comparison to a bruise, I just love that. And then you shared with me a quote by Octavio Paz about searching for words. Do you know that off the top of your head, or...?
Yeah, Octavio Paz says that the poet is left alone without a world to lean on, and because of this, they can create a world anew to name again with words.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, so I felt that this poem, when I read that quote by him, I really thought of this poem, because I almost felt like I was sort of out there without a world to lean on, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lot about, conveys my feelings about being a poet in some ways. So
Yeah, it's I love that my own desire is so strong they are written on my skin, but in a foreign language. So, you know, that does really resonate with that quote, you know, in a foreign language deciphered. So another poem that you mentioned before we started to speak that also kind of deals with you becoming a poet is the poem "I've Carried Rain." So do you want to read that one next?
Okay. "I've carried rain. I freed birds caught in traps, small hearts all a rumble. I'll cry, the crows say, black, blue, and bitten. Their confessions come now to tribunal. I've carried lilacs through rain, broken their branches, and hoped they would not wither. And now I watch starlings on the wire, one by one, drop into unknown shelter. As clouds darken down another notch, the smell of ferns seeps into me. A day to stroll into, to measure shadows, to measure light. And it's only after night falls that I understand. The fern uncurls, the rain still on its leaves, as if wanting to throw itself away in summer."
Great. You mentioned in a note to me that maybe all poems are about becoming a poet, and that this was one of the poems that you felt was a little bit dealing with becoming a poet for you. So can you talk about that a little bit, the idea that all poems are about becoming a poet?
Well, I only noticed that when I was talking about some of these poems, like, Bruise and this one. But I do think that there is a certain, expressing the unexpressible and saying things in a way that you that nothing else can really say it in the way you say it. And then also, you know, surprising yourself as you're writing.
Yeah.
I find that much more with poetry than any other kind of writing.
Does writing poetry help you figure out what you think?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I often surprise myself. You know, I start and I think I have an idea, or I just write words and, you know, things come to me that I probably wouldn't have thought about just, you know, driving in my car or something.
Exactly.
For me, it takes the kinesthetic act of having a pen in my hand and moving it across the page.
Yeah.
Some poets, you know, write in their head. I actually have to be writing.
What about at a computer? You don't do that.
No. I mean, you know, second and third drafts, you know, revisions, yeah, but not, I don't think I've ever written anything right on a computer.
Yeah. Now, it strikes me that the flip side of poetry sort of being able to capture our thoughts and feelings in a way that other communication can't. The flip side of that seems almost like the reader may or may not know what inspired the poem or what it's actually about, if I can say, you know, that something's that a poem is about something. And is that fine with you as the poet? I mean, do you feel like it, as long as they can take whatever they take away from it, that's fine, and they don't need to understand what motivated you in the first place?
I do feel that way. I don't think they have to understand what motivated me, but I do want it to have, you know, I do want it to be something that makes sense to them.
Right.
You know, I don't want it to just be interesting words or, you know, an interesting tone. You know, I do want it to have some meaning.
Yeah.
For them. But it doesn't have to be my meaning.
Okay, great. Now, I noticed as you read that you don't necessarily read your poems around the line breaks that you put on the page. Now, and I don't know what are you supposed to do? Is it all very personal? Does everybody do it their own way? Or are some poets really strict about you've got to read to the line breaks?
You know, I don't know. I think sometimes the line breaks for me can be visual, you know?
Yeah.
And then the other idea is that I don't always read them the same exact way. I might read them differently at a different time.
Right.
Depending on how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
So I just kind of go with how I read it.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of your poetry has birds and bird imagery. And are you just somebody who loves to watch birds, or do you feel like they carry some deeper meaning for you when you write about them?
I would say it's because I'm usually sitting in my living room looking outside.
Okay.
And there's birds there. And then those birds convey things, you know, on a deeper level that's within me.
Yeah.
So they
are so fascinating to watch, aren't they? You can just sit and watch them for
ages. Oh yeah, and they just become other things.
Yeah.
For me, you know, they convey some other message, or they, you know, they take on some other expression.
Yeah. Now you are a poet in the schools, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that work.
Yeah, I was teaching. I taught for 30 years in public schools as a reading teacher. I was also a guidance counselor, and then I was a literacy coach.
Uh-huh.
And when I was doing that, I always the last 10 years I had a very strong poetry program at the school I worked in. So from there, when I retired from teaching full time, I was able to, and I was Poet Laureate of Lancaster, so I was able to get a grant to keep me in the schools just doing poetry. Mm-hmm. So it's been really great. I mean, I get to work in 5 schools a year, usually. Mostly elementary and middle, a little bit of high school, but, it's a very, very interesting, and I've developed a lot of interesting lesson plans around the subject matter. And what we do is it ends up being about the poems end up being around a theme that has to do with something near their school.
Mm.
So it could be history. For instance, Thaddeus Stevens is from Lancaster, and, you know, we wrote about him. The Underground Railroad was here. We wrote about that. One school is near a train, so we took a train into Philadelphia and wrote on the train.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so we always do, like, some kind of experience and then write around that theme. And I really love doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the kids, they just get so much out of it. And
Now, is that a grant that goes on for a certain period of time, or do you have to reapply for it every year, or how does that work?
It's reapplied for every year, but it's through Franklin and Marshall College, through the Writer's House at Franklin and Marshall College.
Uh-huh.
So they take care of that. They take care of all of that, and they hire me to be the teacher.
Oh, great.
And then we do a big program at the end of the day, big kids reading, and we also publish a beautiful book of their poetry.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah.
So, now, you mentioned that you were the first poet laureate in Lancaster. Is it Lancaster County?
Lancaster County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now, yeah. Is that, has your term ended, or are you still the poet laureate?
No, the term has ended.
Okay.
So now they're on the third poet laureate.
Okay.
So, that's, yeah.
But that's really exciting that you were the first.
Yeah, it was very exciting.
Were you aware that was going on, or was it a total shock?
It was kind of a surprise. I was appointed. Now the next, you know, after me, that was it. Then you had to apply. They put out a call.
Okay.
And people apply, but I was appointed. So I was selected.
Neat.
And then I was told or asked if I would like to be the poet laureate, and of course I was thrilled. So, you know, it was really, really interesting. And I was teaching full time then. So in one sense, it was easy for me to do a lot with the students, within my school district. But I worked really hard as poet laureate and tried to do things in the community.
Yeah.
because I've always had a big, I've always been very involved in the community here.
Yeah. Well, just in keeping with talking about your teaching, your work in the schools, I'm wondering if you could read the poem called Story.
Okay. Story. What color is the church in your story? I ask the first grader. She and the other children shout, gold, taking me away from my own version of white clapboard, wheat-colored cornfield in the distance, green hills of alfalfa, just behind two oaks with orange leaves. Is it the gold of Fort Knox or the color of the leaves on the oak? My father would tell us stories with no ending. He'd ask us what happened until we fell asleep. Our dreams tried to answer, and his early death did the same. One cloud moves across the lavender sky, while all the others stand still. The seagull flies miles from the sea, into my view, diving into newly turned earth.
I love that poem. I think it's wonderful. Thank you for reading that one.
Oh, sure.
And I just love the idea of what color is the church in your story, and what color gold is the church, and then how beautifully it transitions into your father, or the speaker's father telling stories with no ending. You know, it is a story, and you know, in some ways, in a way that some poems aren't stories, this one tells a real story, and I loved the title too.
It is fun to teach writing for young kids. And, you know, also my father did tell us stories. It is my father, and he did tell us stories. He called them nothing stories. And he would tell us a story at night, and then when he finally was tired, you know, wanted us to go to sleep, because he would always say, and then what do you think happened? And then we would say what we thought happened, and then he would tell us his version. And then finally he'd say, nothing, it's time to go to bed. And he'd either pick up on the next night, or we would just have to make up our own.
Yeah.
So, but it was such a cool thing, telling nothing stories.
Well, that's, I think, very engaging for kids, because it gives them the opportunity to fill in the nothing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, to make up their own. And so, you know, there you can see part of where, you know, I started with some creativity.
Yeah. It's funny because I really liked your father in this poem. I mean, those three lines, and then I really liked him. And then when you and I spoke beforehand about what you would read, there was one poem called Vito's Kitchen, which I knew had to do with a woman and her not very nice husband. And I was so happy when I found out that was not your father.
that was my grandfather. That was my mother's father, actually. So it was the father calling her in. Yeah.
Oh, it's the father calling the daughter in.
It's the father calling the daughter in. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. All right. Okay, great. Well, you know, since I've brought it up, can we go to that one now and read Vito's Kitchen?
Sure. This poem, my mother was born in 1917, so it's a very different time. And it was based on a story she told me about her father. Vito's Kitchen. Her father whistles from across the street. He wants her to get him a drink of water. She pours in silence, her shadow falling over the white enamel table. She pours in silence the glass of water from the icebox behind him, then returns to her friends. Years later, she hears him whistling for her to come home, just so he doesn't have to turn around.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. It's kind of powerful.
Powerful story.
I mean, for her to tell me.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's a story that's obviously not a story from my own experience, but it's a story that evokes a time and a place for women that was very familiar to me. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Even though I'm not from that time, you know, my mother's from that time, and we all grew up with the remnants of that time. And, you know, it's just such a relief not to be in that time anymore, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. And I think, yeah, we did grow up in the remnants of it. It wasn't to that extreme for right. us, but yet there was so much of that still there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to remember which one. Oh, Have Your Eyes Ever Been Crossed or Turned Out? That's another poem that did that same thing for me, that same feeling of what it was like to be a woman in a certain time. And it's more our time, I think. But do you want to read
right.
that one?
Sure, yeah. This one was kind of based on a dream I had with my aunts, my Italian aunts,
okay.
saying that they looking at something in writing, and I could tell it, and saying, look what she wrote. And it was about, they said it's about grandma. So I knew it was about their grandmother.
Oh.
And then I figured out that it must have been me who wrote it in the dream. So I had to write it.
It's so cool that you dreamt that.
Oh, was, I know.
Right.
I know.
It was like them calling to you to write
exactly,
about
exactly. Exactly. And it wasn't my mother. It was my three aunts, Aunt Fan, Aunt Ginger, and Aunt Pearl.
Wow.
And so and then the next day, after that dream, I went to the eye doctor and I saw this question, and then that kind of sparked something else in the poem. So here's the poem. Have your eyes ever been crossed or turned out? At the eye doctor, I hesitate. Each day of my young life, I wanted to say what the world looked like to me. And what they said was, don't think about that now. Don't see that way. Don't say. My great-grandmother Rosa Vittorito Greco remains inside of me, a voice that did not speak up when she lived. She was left to mind the grocery store in Lambertville while her husband drank at the Elks. Last week, my mother told me, we did what was ever asked of us and thought this was love. As a child, I wrote, oh my goodness, in lipstick on my mother's jewelry box. I wanted her to see me, my jewels, my goodness in words. My grandmother, Maria Concetta Vittorito, tells me in a dream, to love is to be a slave. We lived between raindrops, afraid to be cast out with no place to go. Daughters and their daughters have tried to swim farther, to move into the sea. But still, my eyes learn to turn in, to cross, to be crossed out.
Thank you for reading that. That's great that you went to the eye doctor and that just kind of came into the poem.
I know.
It's
I
really
love that when that happens.
Yeah, well, because it feels like it's meant to be, but it wouldn't have necessarily been anything you'd have thought of otherwise.
No, when I saw that question at the eye doctor, I thought, wow, what a question. Yeah, my eyes have been crossed and turned out.
The other line in this that really stood out for me, I mean, it's really three lines. Don't think about that now. Don't see that way. Don't say. Oh, my gosh. That's like, I thought, oh, that's why she became a poet.
Exactly. When I was reading this, I thought, this is one of those poems. It's about me becoming a poet. Because
yeah.
That's exactly why I became a poet, because I was always seeing things differently and trying to say them and people telling me, don't say it.
Yeah, don't see that way. Don't see that way. Oh, it's wonderful.
Story Started From the End is kind of similar. I mean, it's a similar
yes.
theme, but...
Yes, and I love Stories Started From the End, so let's do that.
Okay, so now this is another one that kind of deals a little bit with women's issues. It didn't start out that way. I started writing a poem purposely from death back to birth. But I wasn't expecting what came in the middle. But this is what came out. Story started from the end. I'd gather my ashes back into their urn, unscatter myself from the far field where rain has soaked me to the darkness. I'd rise and fall back into the world of lunchboxes and scraped knees. The girls' legs are so exposed, while their minds lie unsurprised, their hearts molded, and not their own. They are told how to walk, how to sit, not to speak. Spelling bees are acceptable. Never ask a question. I would rise from the ether they gave my mother when the nurses made me wait for the doctor. A movement unwrapped. The world not ready.
So never ask a question. That just goes to that same impulse.
Yeah. And I did feel that. I did feel as a young girl, you know, in the late 50s that, we weren't encouraged to ask questions.
Spelling bees were acceptable, though. I love that.
That's when you can stand in front of the class and speak, you know?
That was perfect. That was just so great. And it's funny because when I started to read this poem, I did think it was going to be the very interesting idea of starting from the end and going from death back into life. And then it changed so beautifully. I mean, it, to some extent, you know, you go back to the world of lunchboxes and scraped knees, but then it's the exposed legs that kind of made it change. You know, it's like all of a sudden.
Well, because we weren't allowed to wear pants, right?
Right.
We had to wear skirts.
Right. All of a sudden it became about something else.
Yeah. And even the part where my mother's ready to give birth to me. And the nurses won't let me be delivered until the doctor is in the room.
Right. And all of the undertone there is that the nurses are women and that the doctor's a man.
Exactly.
We're all waiting for him.
So, yeah, I mean, I was not expecting that poem to be about that, but I'm glad it was.
And the world not ready. That's fun. That's sort of like, I'm going to write in lipstick, whether you like it or not. Right.
That is true. Yeah.
Okay, great. a few of your poems deal with jazz, which you love. And one of them is early in the collection. It's called In a Silent Way, and it's for Miles Davis, although it has nods to other, you know, music, and I think Jimi Hendrix is in this too. So I'm wondering if you can read that one.
Yeah, I can. And the interesting thing about this poem is I wrote it for Miles Davis. I listened to this piece In a Silent Way. And I only found out recently that he was making a nod to Jimi Hendrix in the piece.
Oh,
and
really?
I didn't know that, but I heard it. So it went in my poem. And then I only recently was reading a book about jazz. About Miles Davis by Quincy Troupe.
Yeah.
And he mentions in there that there was this, you know, kind of that's what Miles was thinking.
So yeah. Isn't that fun when you recognize, I mean, obviously that's what they want you to be thinking about or to recognize on some level.
I thought I just made it, you know, kind of made it up in a way, but evidently no. So.
I remember listening to some music by Amy Mann, and I was sitting with someone, and I'm like, gosh, this little part right here sounds so much like Burt Bacharach, and they're like, you're crazy. And then I went and looked at the back of her CD, and she acknowledges Burt Bacharach, and I'm like, I am not crazy.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll read this one. In a Silent Way, from Miles Davis. Put your body inside that cut where the hand comes out of the ocean and the white egret flies to the marsh, gliding its wing against wind and sky. It's the one right before the slow train heading toward Europe. One blue-black crow stands low where thick limbs separate, and the white sycamore lights a backdrop of differences. The whole time the guitar sounds like Jimmy playing to a flag where the stars are the multiplication table and the stripes reach out for more. Notes lift us when the light diminishes a field and a bird soars through the center of another horizon. Early morning, everything is nearby until you remember your life is still yours and all you want comes slowly. Never what you want by the time it gets to you.
Oh, that's great. It's just such a wonderful ending right there. I love that.
Yeah, I think the ending's a little bluesy, I think, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about that this poem made me think of is, it's not specifically about this poem, but the first line of this poem, "Put Your Body Inside That Cut," follows the last line of the previous poem, "Bruise," which is "Curving the hill in silence, cut from ruins."
Mm.
And I just wanted to ask you about ordering the collection and, first of all, how much input you had and how do you go about it? And is that sort of thing purposeful or is that just sort of funny that I noticed that? And also, is it important to you that people read the poems in order?
No, I don't think it is important that they read them in order because I think very few people actually do, but I do think it's important for you to put them in an order that makes some kind of sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, you know, I didn't notice that cut part at all, really, which I think is very interesting. But I did think the poems had something in common, in terms of, you know, the tone and the feel.
Yeah.
And I guess I love In a Silent Way and thought about using them as the first poem, but Bruise, I do feel it sets a tone for the whole book.
Right.
You know, about, you know, how I see things.
And also you're the artist, and if you start with a nod to another artist, it's less of a statement of yours. It is a statement of yours, and you're doing a nod to Miles Davis in this poem,
that's right.
But to start your whole collection with the, I like Bruise better, that's all. For starting.
I think so too, because it is personal. It kind of, it sets the tone for the book, which is a lot about me, really.
Right.
Or the way I see things.
Sure.
It's not me, it's my way of looking at things.
Yeah.
You know, my sister's a visual artist.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's always saying, you know, it's not about how you draw or what you do, it's about how you see.
Yeah.
And
I was going to ask if you were a visual artist at all, too, because you're clearly inspired by visual art.
Yeah, I am. And I do some art. I wouldn't call myself a visual artist, but I've done a lot of work. I've had a couple shows, but I don't work on it, you know, the way I work on my writing. And my sister was kind of a bit of a child prodigy artist.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up my whole life with her, and we're only about a year and a half apart. And so together, you know, we were looking at the world in our own way.
Yeah.
And she was always pointing things out to me and drawing, and, you know, I mean, so I always had that influence.
Okay. You have a poem called "Ode to the Berrigans," which it has some interesting history behind it, and also you've recently been asked if it could be used in the talks by Isle Press, who wrote a book called "Beautiful Souls." Obviously the poem, you know, it has some historical significance, and it's an interesting poem. So I wondered if you could read that, and then we could talk about that a little bit.
Okay, I think I should explain that the Berrigans were priests. That destroyed draft records during the Vietnam War.
Where were they?
This happened in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Okay.
Where they actually broke into a draft board and went in and destroyed the records. So knowing that is important to the poem.
Sure.
Who the Berrigans are. Not everybody knows who they are. Okay, so "Ode to the Berrigans." I owe to you, my son, whose father would have gone to war, maybe never returning. His fate was set by you that day in New Brunswick, a Sunday spent ripping files, pouring blood. As priest, you marred records. You saved my husband, his number low, but never called. Now the word draft appears again in print, if only to say not yet. Will there be others to take your place, this generation too stunned by the last? You saved my husband, his number low, but never called. Instead, we had a son, his eyes dark brown. Now he writes poems, one about a war he dreads, and one about a war I know he could never have understood. He is opposed to all violence and seems to have come into this world speaking in long sentences about love. Your son as much as ours. Mm.
That's wonderful. Now, do you know that your ex-husband's draft records were destroyed that day?
Yeah, that's where his draft record, because that's where he lived in New Jersey. And
right.
And they did break in that day, and they did destroy draft records. And he was never called, and his number was low. There was a lottery.
Okay, so he probably was one of those people.
So he's almost 100% certain.
Yeah. It's such an interesting poem, first of all, because of the history, and just bringing the history to light in our new history that's developing as we speak. Also, I felt like this poem seemed like it wanted to explain itself more than some of your other poems. Do you mm-hmm. agree about that?
Yeah, because I think when you're talking about history, in a way, you have to. It's not just about you, so you have more of a responsibility, I think, to make it clear. And it's addressing a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, it's addressing the Vietnam War. It also includes the Iraq War. Because, you know, it's this war now.
Right.
Would people, you know, would there be others to take your place? My son, he wrote a poem about war, you know, when we were going into Iraq.
Okay.
And, you know, all of that. So there's a lot going on. I guess I just feel like, you know, you have to.
Yeah. Okay. You have another poem, which I love the title. I mean, I love the whole poem, but the title is so great. And it's How Long is a Minute at the Laundromat? And the laundromat is such an identifiable place. You know, it's so evocative for almost anyone. I mean, I think that mm-hmm. at some point or other in all of our lives, we end up in the laundromat.
So, mm-hmm.
so it's such a great place to write about. Can you read that one?
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long is a minute at the laundromat? Not long enough to leave like the boy in diapers tries to, his mother catching him on the concrete steps. We are on display here, an old grocery store with huge windows and awnings. I imagine all the shelves of cans, a butcher counter in the back, and now the gangs of handkerchief heads run by as if they are chased. How long is a minute here? Not long enough to leave and come back, just long enough to drag a cigarette, if only I smoked. I could stand outside by the payphone or sit on the bench with the others. Long enough to watch 3 commercials on the television. The others waiting are as edgy as I am. I watch the blue linoleum crack with the weight of those walking past. The blue turns into the Madonna's robe, and I remember how she changed. In many paintings, her hair and eyes are dark, her face sad, looking straight at us, while in others she is light and blonde, staring into the child's eyes, or childless and startled by saints. For a few minutes in the Uffizi, I walked behind a curator from New York who explained everything to her teenage daughter. The cross, when worn around the neck, she said, was at first a kind of blasphemy, like wearing a guillotine. I check my pockets again for change. I imagine us here, a whole cult of people, waiting for the minutes to pass. Small electric chairs on gold chains.
Mm. That's a poem that has a lot going on.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, there is. There's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on in that poem. That I just love the moment where you're following the curator from New York around the Uffizi.
mm-hmm.
That's very interesting to be.
I only thought about that because I really looked at the linoleum and thought about the Madonna somehow, the blue with the color of her robe, and then, you know, then I remembered back to that whole moment.
Yeah.
Which, as I said, you know, I often write about things I'm not intending to write about, so.
It just comes about.
Yeah.
Although in this poem, you kind of lead us through the thoughts and the way they change and the reason that they've changed. You know, at this point, you know, you tell us, I watch the blue linoleum crack and the blue turns into the Madonna robe, you know, and it, you are, you're helping us kind of like follow your train of thought.
Right. Yeah.
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 Okay. I love that poem for lots of different reasons, but the title is just, is so great.
Well, it's an interesting idea. And I have to tell you, I the original title came to me as I was in the dorms at Vermont College.
Oh, really?
And I had my, laundry in, and I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? This is so long. You know, it just seems so much longer than a regular minute. You know, and then I ended up writing the poem. And then the whole thing took place really at a laundromat in my mind near here in Lancaster. But, you know, just that whole concept.
It's so funny. Yeah. Because even people who don't have washers and dryers at home would have them at school. So everybody's been there.
Yeah, we've all been there.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
So another great title is the title of the collection altogether. And it's the title is based on one of the poems in the collection. It's called Graffiti in Braille. It's just a great title. I wonder if you can talk about how you came up with that idea, the graffiti in Braille.
Well, it was the title of this poem, and how I came up for that poem, I'm not really sure. I just was trying to grasp for something that this poem has to do with language and seeing. So it fits that poem. But then when I was putting the book together, I really felt like it kind of fit, you know, my poetry because, and poetry in general. Because to me, you know, poetry is trying to express, you know, the unexpressible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of indecipherable, and that graffiti, it's difficult to decipher.
Yeah.
But it's also a little bit counterculture.
Yes.
Which I think some of my poems, you know, have that to them. And then also the idea of the Braille, making it be that you have to use, you know, you have to use the sense of touch.
Yeah.
And making it even more difficult to decipher. So I guess that whole idea of deciphering the world.
Yeah. You know? And in a way, both of those are forms of art which communicate despite something. You know, so, you know, graffiti is often seen as vandalism. It's prohibited. And yet, you know, the artist is putting it out there despite that, you know, and Braille is a way of communicating despite, you know, some sort of physical limitation, blindness, you know.
Yeah. The fact that you can read
without
seeing is pretty amazing. And that there's like this system for it, you know, and
right.
Yeah. So despite the obstacles, the expression is still coming across.
It's going to happen, right?
It's going to happen.
Can't be held back. And then the cover is beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of art. And then sort of behind it or around it, there is Braille on a sort of red background.
Well, the cover was done by a Lancaster artist, David Brumbach, who I ended up writing a poem in his, you know, dedicated to him.
Okay.
That is going to be placed in the main square of the city.
Oh, wow. Now, did he do the cover art for this book, or was it something that you saw and asked him if you could use it?
No, he has died. He died at the age of 44. Mm. So he has not been alive for like 20 years.
Oh, okay.
But he was a good friend of mine, and I have a lot of his artwork.
Okay.
And so I had this piece, and I just felt it fit.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does.
Yeah, I think it fits. So,
when you tell people that you're a poet, do you ever get that comment that, you know, so and so doesn't like poetry, or I don't read poetry because I don't get it? You know, how do you feel about statements like that, you know, about poetry in general? I'm not saying about your poems, but just, you know, when people sort of write off poetry and say, I don't understand it, I don't get it, and so I don't look at it. And how mm-hmm. do you speak to that kind of comment?
Well, I usually ask them, you know, well, where were you exposed to poetry? And it's usually school. And I say, well, you know, I think that you were, you know, you were presented poetry in probably the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And you know, and perhaps not even given a range of kinds of poetry, you know?
Yeah.
I got interested in poetry in high school when I read J.D. Salinger, Franny and Zoe.
Okay.
Because the main character was a poet who only wrote Chinese poetry, although he wasn't Chinese.
Okay.
And I thought that was so fascinating. So I started reading Chinese poetry. So that's what I'm saying. You know, we were exposed to, you know, more like American and British poetry.
Yeah.
And when you start reading, well, I started reading the Chinese poetry. I started reading Spanish poetry. And for me, that was, you know, what got me into poetry. Okay. So I think this, you know, schools don't always present it in a way that's accessible.
Yeah.
At least when we were growing up. I think they do. I think now they do.
Right. Yeah.
A little better. But, yeah. So, I just think most people can come around to seeing right. that, you know, they do understand poetry.
And poetry is such a general term for so much. It encompasses so much. I mean, they just have to find their poets, you know.
Yeah, they have to find poetry that they're interested in.
Yeah.
And you know, even in the elementary school, sometimes kids think they only, you know, like, you know, Shel Silverstein or something. But if you expose them to other poetry that is, you know, more serious, they still really like it.
Yeah. So I want to ask you to read one last poem, please.
Okay.
And that is the poem Contour Drawing.
Okay.
And if you wanted to talk about it at all ahead of time or afterward.
Okay. Well, I think the only, you know, thing to know ahead of time is what contour drawing is, which is you're supposed to look at what you're drawing without looking back at your paper and without picking up the pencil.
Okay.
You can look back once in a while, but not at the same time you're moving your your pencil.
Okay.
That's the way I was taught contour drawing. So that, anyway, I think it's an interesting way of drawing.
Yeah.
Okay, contour drawing. At the very moment she thinks she is hiding, she shows herself. Without even lifting the pencil, I can draw the tiniest bird, the one that lands in front of me. I will capture every feeling she might possess, and mine as well. My thoughts today are simple, like Thoreau's. If life emits a fragrance like flowers and sweet-scented herbs, that is your success. The train whistle in the distance pierces through the locust cry. In early morning, the light hits only the tops of leaves, like white paint saying the words of summer, the mouth does not have to create. The air is much cooler than I thought. I want to be patient and loyal, but still look after myself. I could mark pluses on my paper, hoping zeros or minuses will never appear. I will live with that illusion, not expel it. Try to live close to the earth without picking up the pencil.
That's great. And it's another one that's sort of about a woman finding her voice, mm-hmm. finding a way to express herself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree, or?
Yeah, I definitely agree, and I think that the other, you know, point about this is there's so many different ways to express yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to do it in any one way. And to me, being close to the earth is probably the most important.
Yeah,
you know, way that I feel comfortable expressing myself.
Yeah.
So.
It's funny, as a writer, I I remember once being in a sort of public situation and wanting to use my laptop, but I was sitting so close to people that I felt very self-conscious about actually writing. I don't know if I was on a plane or what. And so I kind of blew the font down so tiny that even I couldn't read it, you know, and it's like that contour drawing. I was just writing without being able to even see the words on the page.
And that's interesting.
Yeah. Now I do that sometimes because it's interesting. It's funny to
and
not
you
look.
You don't edit yourself.
Not in that moment. Right.
Yeah. Or even know what you're writing, but which is kind of the way I do write. I write almost every day, but I don't go back and read it for a really long time.
Yeah. I love this poem, and I think it's a good one to end on.
Okay.
Thank you so much for reading it. And thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Sure. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the poet Barbara Buckman Strasco. You can learn more about her work at barbarabuckmanstrasco.com. In our conversation, Barbara and I discussed the ways that both graffiti and Braille are forms of expression that circumvent some impediment. In the case of graffiti, that impediment might be a lack of authorization. In the case of Braille, blindness. Other examples I can think of include a message in a bottle, skywriting, closed captions on a screen. This week's Write the Book prompt is to create a new form of expression that circumvents some deterrent and write about it, or write using it. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book, and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We were actually the podcast of the week recently on Podbean, which was kind of exciting. We are also available on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever they call that, and Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And that's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. Look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.